Hello?
Hello?
Hello? This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And we got Corey right here. He's got the cans on. He's also wearing a pair of headphones. But Corey, how you doing?
Good, man. I feel like I got to apologize to you and everybody else for like just going MIA for 3 months on the podcast there. I am alive.
Yeah.
And we are coming back. And this is, we're kicking it off with you guys.
Yeah, no kidding. Well hey, Corey, it's good to see you. And we should say managing broker and El Presidente at William Wright Commercial Real Estate Services.
Yeah. Also janitorial director of staple operations and paper finding around the office. All the hats still and then some.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you used to do the conveyancing over there, Corey, wasn't that right?
Well, I had to, because I couldn't afford to pay anybody else for like the first 8 years, right? So we kind of got to the threshold now that our rent's paid, our lights are on, and the staff, we can actually finally pay a full season staff. We're almost a borderline real business here. Once we get rid of the plastic forks and knives in the kitchen and go to like real IKEA ones, we're like, look out.
Well, Corey, thanks for taking the time today. We're going to keep you around for the intro because we got a couple things we got to do before we get to our conversation about not only the commercial market, but we're talking about all things real estate today, some commercial, some residential. So we're going to kind of meander all over the place a bit. But before we get to that, of course, we've got the realist headlines. These are the weekly headlines in real estate. And these are brought to you by The Realist, a Substack publication founded by Howard Chai. Of course, a really spectacular Substack that we, of course, follow. So the headlines this week, Matt, a couple. FIFA kicked off, not really related to real estate, but of course, we're seeing some renewed energy in Vancouver right now. Just go check out the Granville. I was going to say the Granville Strip, but I'm not sure that's what they call it?
Pedestrian zone.
Yeah, the pedestrian zone. Yeah.
Have you been down there? I think I'm going down today.
I might be down there today as well. I'm at something at the Commodore today, so I may see you down there. But have you been down there, Corey? Your office is not too far.
I'm not kidding. If I could turn my screen, I look like a gargoyle staring over top of it. We're literally at the corner of Granville and Robson. Right. So it's like I get like yesterday, there's people blowing crap up and flames everywhere. It's awesome. And I'll be honest with you, I think it scares everybody away. It takes me like an hour to get to work. I got here in 35 minutes today. Like no one is like scared all the employees out of downtown. But I'm literally going to stay with my popcorn later and just watch the disaster unfold.
I was going to say, though, this sounds like old Granville, not FIFA Granville.
It's stuck great.
And blown
it's
up.
It's great. Like yesterday, there was, I'm guessing either Brazil or Australia was playing. There's like a sea of yellow going down and they got yellow flares everywhere and there's smoke everywhere. And so it's great. I feel like a gargoyle watching the whole thing from my office.
Right.
That's
on.
Great.
Well, the next headline from The Realist, Adam and Corey.
Yes.
Bank of Canada again held its interest rate. I think that was pretty much assumed at this point. Not a lot of news, but any thoughts?
I think it was to be assumed. And I think obviously with the war kind of coming to an end yesterday, which obviously that worked out really well. I think that's going to hopefully kind of get inflationary costs kind of trekking downward, and we're kind of hopefully going to land where we land in a good way.
Right, right. And the last two headlines, and we've been talking a lot about on our show, and Corey, we're going to get your take today on lease rates in the commercial world, but just in the residential rental world, rents have fallen year over year for the 30th consecutive month now, according to rental.ca's latest report. And also that was just published was the CMHC 2026 mid-year rental market update. Lots of key insights here. First of all, just in looking at the national average rents, any thoughts on or any guesses as to what Vancouver's average rent total is?
I'll let Corey go first.
Okay, I'm going to go $15.36 and 16 cents.
I will go 15.36.17. Yeah. No, I'm going to go. I feel like, Corey, you've been in Coquitlam too long.
Isolated.
That might be I feel like that's that might be low. I'm gonna say average. It's tough, right? Because there's like legacy rent in there. Presumably,
is Corey renting out for $1,500 a month? He's been renting dog houses in his backyard. I think
this parking
is,
stall apparently.
Yeah, $2,350.
No, you guys are both light. So the average rent is $2,712 in Vancouver.
I was trying to factor in people that have been in their space for say 10 years, and
my number included the West End buildings that have been there for 100 years, and those people haven't moved out.
We both have logic too.
I had a lot of weight. I weighted my number quite heavily on the West End rents there from the old walk-ups.
Now that we've discredited everyone on this call before we get started here, let's
get to the real segment. The segment that remains nameless, our quiz segment.
Yes.
Here's one for both of you. It's a residential question, so apologies in advance, Corey.
I'm all over it.
Okay, so we're just talking sales ratios here for North Vancouver. Okay, May 2026 sales ratios. We have two segments. We have single family homes in North Van, and we got attached, so condos and townhomes. Which of these two segments was a seller's market and which was a balanced market? And by that, I mean, you know, so let's call it over 20% in terms of sales ratio being a seller's market and under being balanced.
So to increase the odds.
But before we get to that, Corey, we get to that, we have a listing we wanted to highlight. Adam's going to highlight one of our listings.
Found
over at Scalena Real Estate or at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
I absolutely love this listing. So this is 1924 Kitchener, beautiful single family detached house that's been converted into three suites. So this is nearly 2,700 square feet, Matt. And it's got, you know, like original fir floors, over height ceilings, the leaded glass windows. So it's three self-contained suites, a three bedroom and two bedrooms. Fantastic rental rates. I think it was rented for around $7,700. But easily converted back into a single family dwelling, which would be easy to do. The stairs have been retained. So a couple of things. We all know the area. It's basically a block in from Victoria on Kitchener. So you could throw a baseball to Commercial Drive, close to obviously Victoria Park, which is really nice. And so many amazing things close by all the gems of Commercial Drive. So anyways, that's on our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. $1,949,000. So basically 195, and learn more about it on the site.
Screaming deal. And don't forget, Adam, in the opposite direction to Live For Bakery, Renzullo's, Folietta, doesn't get much better than where that house is. But anyway, let's get back to our question. So which was a seller's market, detached or attached?
So just
Vancouver.
Just to favor us, one is, they're each one. They're not both the same. So one is balanced, one is a seller. They're not both balanced, they're both sellers.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I'm going to go detached, balanced, detached, seller. Adam, if you go the opposite, we're going to nail this. One of us will get this right.
I'm going to go the opposite, because I think Matt would assume that I'm going to say that the detached was a seller's market, but I can see more pressure in the attached market in North Vancouver right now, because I feel like we've seen a bit of an uptick in attached. So I'm going to say the exact opposite of Corey. Final answer.
The answer is attached was a seller's market and detached was balanced. So attached condos and townhomes was at a 22% sales ratio, just into that seller's market, where the detached market was just under 18%. So not a huge difference, but kind of interesting, because you're right, Adam. It cuts against the grain of what we've been talking about on the program. And I think it cuts against the larger story of North Vancouver in 2026. I feel like detached has been really strong. But
out of curiosity, which was the strongest submarket in North Vancouver?
Well, Adam, I don't have that in front of me. I'll pull it up.
If you had to guess.
Oh, if you had to guess?
Yeah.
Okay, you have it.
Well, I've
Corey,
got it
do you
right
want to
here,
take yeah. a stab at this?
Well, so far my residential is great. I'm renting out places for $1,500 downtown, which is half price. And I picked the complete opposite of what the market's doing. So that keeping that in mind, I'm going to go Lower Lonsdale.
Okay. So this is which market is strongest for detached?
This is for attached.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I feel like it's got to be. I think it's got to be Lower Lonsdale. I was thinking. No, you know what? I'm going to go Central Lonsdale just to spice it up, Corey.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
Central's yes. north of 12th, right? I get 12th and under, you get 12th and over.
Okay. Well, what was the answer? Here it is. Yeah. So the answer is the strongest submarket is Queensbury.
Oh.
So at 38% sales ratio. Yeah.
How many listings, though?
Well, here's the thing. So in Queensbury, there were 8 listings and 3 sales.
Not bad. Not bad.
Nailed that one too. Put another notch under my belt, my residential career.
When you look at Lower Lonsdale, just on a side note, just to check out how Corey's logic was, there was 174 listings and 37 sales. So still a light seller's market with that 21% sales ratio in Lower Lonsdale. So still, I mean, good news for sellers of condos or attached product in Lower Lonsdale for sure. And definitely the most supply.
What about Central Lonsdale?
Yeah, Central Lonsdale. Let's see here. Now we're looking at Central Lonsdale had 112 listings and 19 sales. So 17%. So falling in the balanced market. So Corey, we're going to give you that.
I'll take it. I need it.
This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial, John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
Zentera has done it again. Recently named Multifamily Home Builder of the Year by the Home Builders Association of Vancouver and the Canadian Home Builders Association of BC. Zentera continues to move forward on new projects. And their latest, Butte, a new condo community in West Clayton, is now selling. With construction already underway, buyers can purchase with confidence, knowing that the project is moving forward.
Butte offers 1, 2, and 3-bedroom condos located just 3 blocks to the future SkyTrain Adam. These condos come with tons of inclusions like gas ranges, air conditioning, and designer-selected finishes. Residents will have access to the rooftop patio, fitness center, on-site daycare, co-working space, games room, and tons of outdoor space with 3 playgrounds. Estimated completion is summer 2028.
The best deals are happening now. Visit Zentera's home store in South Surrey to get all the details or check out the floor plans at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca. Okay, so we're here back with Corey Wright, obviously managing broker at William Wright Commercial, owner managing broker. Corey, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. 14 years ago now, I guess it is, we started William Wright Commercial. I'm going to be very biased to say I think we have the best commercial team in the industry. And I think what we're sort of experiencing right now versus what the market is can kind of back that up a bit. We have 6 offices. Throughout the province, which makes us the largest dedicated commercial brokerage by office count. Victoria, Nanaimo, Fraser Valley and Langley, downtown Vancouver, Kelowna and Kamloops. We've got kind of all your major regions covered. And, maybe who knows? Maybe we'll end up on the other side of the Rockies next year. We'll see what happens.
Wow, you buried the most important thing, host of the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest with you, my head's kind of between my tails because I've gone to MIA in a couple months and I'm pretty sure you guys are about ready to fire me. This is probably my final cattle call here, but we are coming back. We are coming back. We've been so busy, which is no excuse by any stretch of the imagination, but we're coming back. We're coming back.
Nice. Well, Corey, maybe as a launching point here, how is the commercial market doing? And I know it's hard to talk about the commercial market just generally, but can we talk about kind of Metro Vancouver a little bit, and then we'll maybe move on to the province, but just kind of like a health check on the province or on the MVR.
So, I can speak to what we're seeing as a brokerage. And from talking to other brokers and other companies, which we always have great relationships with, I feel like we're probably one of the busier brokerages out there right now. When I say busier, I'm not saying pricing has gone up, but I'm saying transactions. And I really feel there was a lot of anticipation for 2025 coming out of 2024. And then when Trump dropped the tariff word, it really scared everyone and sort of set everyone back. It wasn't towards the end of last year where I think we kind of felt that people kind of felt a little bit more on steadier ground. And I think in 2026, vendors especially, I think have finally come to reason that 2021 pricing is officially off the table in 2026, meaning that if the property might have been worth $3 million before, now they've come to realization it's worth 2.5 or 2.4, and they're listing it at more of a market price in 2026, and that's aligning both buyers' and sellers' expectations. And that's where I think you're seeing a lot of transactions coming from, even on the leasing side of things. I think we're seeing an uptick in leasing. Even areas like office, which has typically been very challenging over the past few years, that even feels like it's moving in a little bit in the right direction. And I think when you look at it from an investment standpoint, there's been several big office buildings sold downtown, which I think is speaks well to the market, at least in the long term, where I think a lot of people are looking at it as there's value there because they're getting things at probably a much higher cap rate now. Although they're absorbing a higher vacancy rate, they're getting a much higher cap rate. And Vancouver traditionally isn't a office market. And by that, I mean, I was in Calgary a couple of weeks ago, and they've got office buildings to spare everywhere versus in downtown Vancouver, we're landlocked. But a lot of downtown Vancouver is condos. We're not a traditional downtown core versus you go downtown Calgary, there's very little condos. It's all office buildings. And believe it or not, like Tim Hortons and Starbucks and stuff like that, a lot of them are closed on the weekends because there's just that, there's not the activity downtown. So Vancouver benefits from that. All that said, there's not a lot of offices out there compared to kind of the size of city that we are versus maybe a Calgary or even a Toronto for that matter. So I think that sort of bodes well for the long-term absorption slowly gets taken back. I think absorption's been challenging and probably slower than a lot of people thought. But overall, I think transaction volume is up. I think optimism is definitely up a little bit from where we saw end of last year. But I think buyers and sellers, landlords and tenants, I think are more aligned now in 2026 values, which is allowing a lot more properties to transact than we may have seen in previous years.
Just a quick question about the kind of the post-COVID office environment. So I remember that was a stat that a lot of people were talking about, is that Vancouver was still had one of the lowest vacancy rates for office coming out of COVID. Is that really, this is the first time I've kind of heard it positioned that way. Are we just a very small supply stock for the general population? And is it because cities like Calgary and other places across Canada, their downtowns are full of commercial office buildings?
Well, I think Vancouver is definitely an outlier. And I think when if you go back to kind of pre-COVID, depending on what report you read, you know, people would probably earmark the downtown office market, maybe in a 3% vacancy, which is really unhealthy. Like a balanced market might be like 8 to 10%, which would be more like a New York type of market. But a 3% vacancy rate, or even a 4% vacancy rate for office in the downtown core is very unhealthy for tenants. It's great for landlords, but very unhealthy for tenants. So that spurred a lot of development into the office sector pre-COVID. And I think when you come out of COVID, obviously the office market looked completely different. And then you had a bunch of supply coming on that was planned pre-COVID, which is going to kind of, I don't want to say skewer the numbers, but you're adding a bunch more inventory to a market that doesn't have a great absorption right now. So that coupled with the fact is downtown does not have a lot of office buildings per se versus a downtown Seattle or even a Calgary, which is primarily made up of office buildings. We've got some beautiful neighborhoods like Yale Town and the West End and Cole Harbor, which are primarily residential developments versus that. So I think all of that said, I think the office market will start to see some more absorption in the coming years. I think landlords have had to have more inducements out there for tenants. I think the tenants' faces have probably changed as well. I mean, maybe a tenant that once was 30,000 square feet, maybe 20 now, because maybe there's a hybrid model or they have a hub and spoke model now where they have a smaller office in Surrey, smaller, a bigger, I have an office in Surrey now that didn't exist years ago. And they have a smaller office in Vancouver. So they've kind of re-spread that. They've kind of redeployed that staff into various things. But I'm very bullish on the office market. I think the office buildings are going to become a flight to quality, where I think you're going to have to be able to have more amenities like end of trip services or gym facilities and stuff like that to make it more appealing to a tenant, maybe than what you had to do years earlier, a rooftop patio or something like that. But I would definitely say I'm bullish on it. I'll put an asterisk next to that. I don't know how quickly things will get absorbed, probably slower than everybody wants, but it feels like there's a little bit of optimism now. And when you look at buildings downtown that have sold, you know, the billionaire behind Zara had purchased a building. He argued he might have got a much higher cap rate on that than what he would have got years earlier. So I think if you're penciling long-term money, an office building in a downtown core like Vancouver, which doesn't have a lot per se compared to population and all of that stuff, might be a pretty good investment, because you're getting probably a much higher cap rate today, as long as you can pencil your numbers for the medium to long term. And you hold an asset that's not going to come off, then they don't come around very often for sale. There's not a lot of them to sell.
So, Corey, you mentioned that William Wright's doing more transactions or the most transactions. I'm kind of curious if that's across the board, like transactions are up. Like, are we seeing, apart from your brokerage, are transactions up? What does that mean for pricing? And what does that mean, do you think, for the cycle? Like, where...
Yeah.
Like, so because we've really, you know, in terms of sellers and buyers kind of finding, like, have we found the floor?
I would definitely, I think if I had a crystal ball, I wouldn't be joining you guys right now. All three of us would be sitting on a yacht in Barbados with me. But I definitely feel like we're getting closer to that. And where I kind of come up with that is if you look at kind of like strata product, and maybe you want to talk about industrial as an example, you mean, a lot of developers paid a lot of money for land, and building costs have not gone down very much. So when you're looking at some projects that might have had, $750, $775 a foot attached to an industrial product, as great as it's built, that's a very high number. Well, you might see some of those assets start coming down into that $500, $550 a foot range, where I think you can try to draw some conclusions as a bottom is that product probably won't ever get sold on the new side of product, that is, at those prices, because the land is too much and the building costs are too much. So when you start looking at that, where they can't really sell it any less, that kind of almost bottoms out of what that new development will look like moving forward. We might not be at $775 a foot, but if I pick something up for $500, that probably costs very similar pricing to repeat that thing. Developers are going to buy and build that product for that price moving forward. That's going to have less supply available, and that will create greater absorption once around. If you look at an office unit, let's say industrial office unit on Henning Drive as an area at Burnaby, that's kind of a really unique, they have some M5 zonings there. And if you look and you bought an office space there for $600 a foot that's built out, that maybe at its peak was $700 or $750. When you look at that, buying that at $600 a foot that's built out, well, if I back out those costs to build out that office, I might be $450 a foot if that was a shell. Well, you can't build and deliver that and sell that for $450 a foot. So that, I think, is going to try to create some comfort around that maybe there is a little bit of a bottoming happening. Now, new supply isn't going to get built as fast as it did because those prices aren't going to make sense for developers with it, unless land costs and construction costs fell dramatically, which the chance of construction costs coming off probably enough, probably wouldn't really offset the price they're paying for land as much as it has come down with it. But when you start looking at things that way, if I pay $600 for the office space, but it might cost me $150 to actually build this from shell, well, my net number is $450. Well, that number hasn't existed in a long time and probably won't ever exist again in new sales. That might create a comfort for a buyer to buy it, saying, hey, I can't really get it. I'm not going to lose a lot here. Versus if I paid $900 or $1,000 a foot for that space, that might be a different story.
What about for different asset classes? So we're talking, that's new industrial, which was the darling of the COVID era, right? Industrial was what everybody was on about. And it's had a significant correction, as you just outlined. Multifamily, because, clearly there's rental compression. I think you were citing your numbers from the West End at 1650 in the intro. Yeah. So there's the challenges still there. What's going on in multifamily?
Definitely think there's challenges because it was a safety net for so long where I could buy it. I was buying it at maybe a 3.5 cap rate, which a lot of people scratched their head on it. But how you achieve that is you get longer amortization periods and longer terms, CMHC-backed mortgages. So it kind of makes everything relevant. But now, if I'm buying something at 3.5 and I don't have a 1% vacancy, I got a 3 or 4% vacancy on it. You got to kind of really kind of consider those numbers because that vacancy cost, that vacancy costs the landlord money. I have a budget for the building it takes me to operate that I'm collecting gross rents I need to pay in. And also I have debt servicing I have to fill that if I have a greater vacancy rate, my true numbers might be a lot less. Because what a lot of people may forget is if I have a commercial building, let's say, and my operating budget's $200,000. This would obviously be a stacked office building or something like that. It's $200,000 to operate the building and it's 25% vacant. Well, the landlord has to kick in that extra 50 grand in the shortfall of the budget. Those costs don't go away. Property taxes, you don't get a reduction on your property taxes because you're 25% vacant. You pay the full property tax. So when you take that logic and you put it into fruition with multifamily buildings, and I'm getting them at a much lower cap rate than maybe I'm comfortable with, and I have higher operating costs with higher vacancy, my safety net maybe doesn't really exist as much as I thought it did. And when you look at a lot of these wood frame walk-ups, that you're not in a position to go replace all the rooftop units and actually recapture any of those costs. Those are capital costs you got to sink in because you don't have triple net leases. With that said, because you're not getting a lot of things built right now on the residential side, and you're going to fast forward 5 years and everyone's going to be screaming like, oh my gosh, we've got this like crazy housing crunch. How did we not see this? Well, there's a lot of restrictions on building new products under REDMA and all the stuff that comes along with that. And then you go one step further, when you take away a lot of these Airbnbs in these markets, you're putting a whole bunch more inventory into the multifamily quotation market there because the average investor that maybe bought their place to Airbnb it, they're now a long-term renter of the space. So, you get a whole bunch of these things that kind of kick into that market there. And I think the other thing is having international students not around and international buyers not in the marketplace and all that stuff that's restricted. I think that's had a greater impact than I think a lot of people really thought. And now immigration's flat for the more so. You mean you're not getting 10 years of immigration in 3 years that's continuing to create demand to backfill every unit that's vacant. Now that you're getting more of a steady drip of immigration on a flat cycle now, I don't want to say we're overbuilt, but now it's kind of like, whoa, now we're more into maybe a more balanced market than we were a landlord market for years earlier. So all of that said, I think multifamily is not a bad investment. I think you have to be a little more cautious now than you had to be 3 or 4 years ago.
What's the asset type that you think everybody's sleeping on right now?
Sleeping on as in
there's probably some opportunity, but you're still seeing it as a fairly dead market.
Well, here I would always push people to buy like Class B industrial in like a secondary market. And why that is, Class B, if you take the concept of the tide raises all boats, if I have a Class B asset that's within a stone's throw of a Class A asset, and I'm getting 10 bucks a foot, and the Class A is getting 20. Well, there's a high probability my renewals are 15. Why is that? Because that Class A just brought my value up purely based on market demand. I'm not going to get the 20, but I'm going to get more than 10 because 20 is the other option. So I think if you look into secondary markets or markets like the Fraser Valley, which are great markets, which right now you probably have a better deal on industrial as an example, and you buy into like a Class B where you're not going to be as rocked or affected as like a Class A new construction would be. As long as you can stomach a little bit higher vacancy rate than maybe you once did before, I think you'll do very, very well. Because even when you look at markets like Kelowna, you can buy industrial for 200 to 250 bucks a foot for Class B stuff, but they can't even reproduce that for that much. So the chance of that product actually coming in to compete with you is very slim. If new product comes aboard, it's going to be new construction. And that's going to be Class A, and people will be paying 300, 350 bucks a foot for that product. So if I can buy a Class B asset that's within a stone's throw of a Class A asset, then I can then get higher rents because the Class A asset is going to drag me up and I have low risk. I can get much more for my money. I'll do that deal all day long. That is where I think like people direct their attention towards. If you're looking for something that maybe doesn't have a lot of eyes on it right now, that I think will be a really, really smart investment 3 or 4 years down the road.
So the interesting thing there is, and it, I mean, there's, these are totally different markets, of course, but in residential, we often talk about tier one, tier two type properties. Yeah. And what we've seen this year, you know, is something to sell has to check every single box and be priced right. Right. But it's tier one properties that are selling in the tier two, the stuff that, you know, people would overlook all sorts of objections, I guess, during the hotter times in the market are sitting. And in some cases, it's like, what would we have to do to move this? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't sound like, it sounds like, is that kind of logic playing out in commercial as well? Because it sounds like the tier two is actually the play.
I would say it's the play. Because if you look at the tier one stuff, tier one being new construction, which is some of, there's some phenomenal projects, and I'm not going to name names, but there's some amazing industrial projects that were built that probably had a 700 to high 700 a foot price tag on it in pre-construction sales. And now the developers are sitting on tons of unsold inventory. And now they're pretty much looking to, like, I won't say blow them out, but you might be doing a deal like 550 or 525 a foot. And you're seeing some developers do like lease to own, which is not typically what they'd want to do, but their cost to carry the unsold inventory is very high. This is trying to offset it. So when you look at stuff like that, that's where you'd be most vulnerable, I think, to the market. First, you buy something class B, you're going to get it dramatically less. And when you look at industrial as an example, it's like four walls. Yeah, granted, you got power and ceiling heights, and there's stuff like that, loading bays that will 100% play, will impact the investment. But I'm not giving you a $40 a foot TI to go build a restaurant in there. I might give you a couple months free rent and some keys. So it's very much more hands-off from a thing. And it's really similar product. The difference between new construction and old construction, ceiling heights will play a factor. Some of the newer stuff has really nice second floor offices that maybe you don't get in the older product there. But there are also a lot of times two different tenancies. The old product might be like a cabinetry company. And the newer product might be like an online business where they've got like the internet people sitting upstairs in the office. Maybe they have a small showroom below and the warehouse is in the back. So they're two kind of different tenant pools. In some cases, when you look at that, that internet company typically isn't going to be going into the Class B product that the millworking company is in.
Can we talk about the secondary markets that are kind of the best buy right now in your mind?
I've always been a big component of, I think Kelowna is a great market. I still think there's a lot of runway there. I think Vernon's a great market. Vernon, I think, gets a lot of offshoot from Kelowna. I think Kamloops is a great market. And I think Nanaimo is a great market. I think Victoria's had its challenges, no questions asked. I think when you look at Victoria, maybe the downtown area more so than anything, you know, you're seeing more vacancy now. The tourism market isn't as robust as it was because of Airbnb restrictions. I believe that kind of really played in. You know, UVic is a really big school, and, you know, not having the international students and stuff like that, I think is playing a little bit of havoc with that market. But if you look at these secondary markets, those four I just named, I think I'm huge components of people buying in those markets. And one thing I think that drives those markets more so than other ones is they are constrained from a land perspective. Kelowna's, you know, it sits on a lake, right? So and you got your geographical challenges are all around you. You still got lots of people coming, but location, location, location is more important in those markets than anywhere. Buying something in Kamloops because it has a Kamloops address on it, and you think it's in the downtown core, doesn't mean success. Location, location, location. And if you look at markets like in Nanaimo, which you're getting a lot of still, you know, immigration up island still, you know, you got a lot more people where it's still affordable for people to come in. It's a beautiful community over there. And the fact that you're buying things dramatically below replacement cost value almost kind of guarantees no one else is going to build them because they can't afford to build them. If I can buy something at a 5 cap rate at has a replacement cost value of $5 million, but I can buy it for 3, no one's thinking, hey, let's buy the land. And let's go build this for 5 and let's sit here with our 2.5 cap rate when we're done. Like, that's not happening. A lot of the newer retail in some of these areas, such as these secondary markets, sits in the bottom of brand new towers that are getting built, which right now aren't getting built. So you're not having that retail kind of come into those markets, the newer retail come into those markets to compete with some of the older product. So location, 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 I think is like super important when you're considering those secondary markets to buy into.
So in thinking of those secondary markets, like one thing that I'm not so sure is actually the case in the residential world, but when you think about, you know, a Kamloops. It's like, yeah, you know, there were investors became interested in all those secondary markets in the residential space, right? But yeah, it wasn't the same as Metro Vancouver. Like it was a very, correct, it was like a muted version. Same thing even in Victoria. And I think, yeah, when you look at pricing in Victoria, like pricing in the residential, on the residential side is not as far off in Victoria. And I think the logically, or at least my take on it is because it's kind of more of an end user, you know, end user market. It wasn't as inflated. Is that the case in commercial? I mean, everybody's an investor in commercial primarily.
Yeah.
But like, are prices more stable in those markets, or have they come off the same as Vancouver?
Well, they've definitely come off with regards to cap rates. Like cap rates have obviously kind of have been inflated a bit. But one thing I think that differs a lot in commercial versus residential, if I'm an investor per se, is I'm dealing with RTA agreements, which are 1 year in length. I'm very subject to instant market movement, good or bad. In commercial, I might have a tenant who signs a 10-year deal, and the rents are going to be what the rents are going to be, regardless to what that property is worth at that time. And even coming out of COVID, I remember talking to a reporter who was pretty much teeing me up to try to bait me into saying about the fire sale properties that are all going to be coming here in COVID, you know, post-COVID when interest rates go rise up. And I told him, the difference is if somebody has a 10-year lease in place with me, they're paying the rent regardless to what the building's worth. I'm not really as subject to instant market conditions because I'm not re-renting my property hypothetically every year. I have long-term rents in place with it. And I think when you look at commercial, cap rates definitely have gone up, which has pushed prices down. But there's never really enough commercial in where you want it to be because retail nodes are just that. They're not huge. So there's not a lot of product in that market. Industrials can maybe more of a logistical play than retail is, maybe proximity to highways and stuff like that. Offices, again, no one's really building a lot of offices in secondary markets. The best example I use, if you look at Nanaimo as an example, and I'm just going to make up numbers here, these aren't accurate, but let's say there's like 8 office buildings per se in Nanaimo, downtown Nanaimo. Well, fast forward 10 years, I'm going to put my money on, there's still only 8 office buildings in downtown Nanaimo because it costs too much money to recreate it. If we have a building that's hypothetically worth $8 million, it probably costs $11 million replacement cost value just for the building before I put the land in play. So when you're looking at that stuff, is as more and more people move in, the chance of that getting recreated or rebuilt is very slim. So as population grows, commercial always lags. People show up. Now they need jobs. They got to go work somewhere. That's where the pressure will start to continue to rise on that office asset because now I'm growing my population by 20% over that time period, 10 years, but I've grown my office market by 0. Well, my population goes up by 20%. More people need jobs in the community and there's no more office space built. That office space is going to have pressure. Rates are going to go up. Demand is going to go higher and the landlords win.
I'm curious.
I realize Corey, now I probably haven't answered any questions.
It's all making landlords sense.
Win. That was the takeaway. Yeah.
We get a shirt.
Well, and here, so yeah. So Corey, here's the thing. So we in peak times we were maybe, and I'm trying to remember now, but call it like 25% of our market in the residential side was investors. Right. Right now, It's got to be at all time lows, or it's very low compared to the peak time. What's happening with investors in commercial? Like, are you seeing has the ratio changed from end user to investor for buyers?
Well, I think you have to look at each individual asset class to draw that conclusion. So, if I'm industrial, especially small bay, we'll call small bay sub 3,000 or sub 2,500 square feet. That was always usually your largest owner occupier to investor ratio. You might have had like 50, 60, 70% of them were owned by end users because they could own the property for the same price they could lease it. And then over the past decade, industrial went on a really good run and a lot of investors started getting into the property. So now you have greater buyer pool for property. You have great absorption year over year. So you can draw the conclusion it's ongoing demand because hundreds of thousands of square feet are getting delivered every year, but the vacancy rate's not moving. That's ongoing demand. So when you look at that asset class, that's one of the reasons why prices shot up so much. And now all the investors in that asset class are probably shrinking year over year because they're like, there's no money in this thing here for us. Prices are going to come down and then probably eventually shift back into more of like an owner-occupier market than what it once was. Right now, if you could hypothetically draw a conclusion that maybe it was like 75% owner-occupiers to 25% investors, that number would have swayed dramatically in the investors' favor over the past 10 years, where maybe now it's 50-50 for argument's sake. Well, that's an asset class that will probably revert back to more owner-occupiers and less investors because now you're going to get these crazy runs on that. Now, you take that same model and you apply it to retail, which traditionally is much more expensive per foot than what it is, that a lot of investors can't really buy their own product. I can't go afford to pay $2,000 a foot or $2 million my 1,000 square foot retail space for Corey's coffee shop. So in that market, you're always going to have traditionally way more investors than you will end users. Now, I'm not saying the end users didn't maybe creep up over the years with more strata product available, but that's an asset class that will always be very lopsided. And we look at the offices, until we had the strata boom years ago that brought a lot more strata offices to the market, there wasn't a lot of strata offices per se to speak of. You were more buying, like renting a place in an office building owned by a pension fund. So when that strata market really took off, there became a lot more opportunities. And when you look into markets like Coquitlam, for example, I mean, there's a great project there that was built that probably was, you know, sold $750, $800 a foot to the original buyers in it that were probably peaking at like $1,100-ish a foot for a shell. And now why would I go buy that for $1,100 and brag to my friends I own it when I can lease it probably for half the price? So a market like that, I think, will naturally shift back. So that's a market that was probably more investors that had much more owner-occupiers enter into it. And now it's probably slowly going to revert back over time because all the owner-occupiers that occupy their spaces aren't looking to jump ship right away. But the investor pool is not lining up to pay $1,200 for strata properties, especially when you have greater inducements. So I think it's very isolated to the asset class that you're in and probably the market that you're in too.
This might be a tough question or too broad to answer, but it's one of the kind of perplexing things that I've been thinking about a lot. Like one, and you've mentioned it a bunch of times here today, like replacement cost, right? Like you can buy things for well below what it would take to rebuild them, probably, and not even factoring in land costs. Right. What we're seeing in Metro Vancouver, as I understand, for land assemblies is people who own single family homes that live near developments are being propositioned by developers with offers that are below their assessed value. So like there will be 3, 4, 5 houses that all get the same offer. And if the assessed value is 1.5, they're getting offers at like 1.35 and they should all jump at the same time kind of thing, which is ludicrous and it doesn't make sense. And those guys could each bring their house to market, probably sell it, you know, depending on the condition, but let's call it an assessed value right now, or maybe even above. So assemblies are the opposite of what everybody remembers, where people were getting assessed and a half or 2 times assessed value. So there's no incentive for anyone to assemble land right now. Right. So how do we get out of this logjam? Because if prices were just coming off, right? Like if you could sell your house to an end user for, you know, 1.3 and a developer for 1.35, and you could get, that's probably still not worth it to get your neighbors involved, right? Like not enough incentive. But right now you can literally probably find Jane and Tim and their 3-year-old to buy your house for more than a developer is willing to pay you and 3 or 4 neighbors. So like how do we get out of this? What does that look like? And how long does it take? Because it strikes me as like it's maybe years of just stasis.
Well, I think it's a multi-answer question. By that, I mean, I think it's not just the land prices, but it's also the sellable prices of condo, demand for condo, REDMA. And then you also have an abundance of court-ordered sales out there. And in our market, quotations, everybody was a developer years ago. Like, you know, you buy a house on Cambie Street, happens to be a corner lot, and you paid $2.6 million for it. And then you sell it 24 months later for $3.4 million. And you're bragging to your buddies in your Porsche that all this value that I created in my property because I'm a developer and all this stuff. And you had a lot of that happening, speculation essentially, in our market, that now you have a lot of property that's probably worth pennies on the dollars for what people paid for. And there was a lot of logic. If you build it, they will come. So people were probably getting a lot of that. I'm so invincible. I'm going to buy this property off Heather on a back corner. But you know what? Demand's so great. It's going to be a development site. And that market never materialized. So you've got a lot of inventory right now on the development side that is selling for far less than what it's bought. And you almost got to kind of like let that do its course. I think there's more blood in the water on the development side for the foreseeable future. But you got to kind of let that run its course. And then people are now realizing, like, hey, developing actually is an art. Like, it's not as easy as everyone thinks it is. So the good ones are probably still developing, slower pace though, but still developing. They're probably still making money with the developments that they bought the land, right? But you get all of the speculators kind of run their course. And then when you look at it on the developer side of things, well, if I'm sitting on too much inventory, I too might want to cut off the arm here. So I might sell some stuff for a little bit less, but keep the better product. So that's got to run its course. And then when I look at selling a product, I have this thing called REDMA that looms over my head, the Real Estate Development and Marketing Act, which means by the time I put my product on sale, I got 12 months to not only get my building permit, but secure my construction financing. If my ratio of sales is going up, or maybe I had to get 30% of my project sold to kick in my financing, now I might have to get 60% of my product sold to kick in my financing because the banks aren't super eager to finance new construction right now. So I've got all these limitations or ceilings on me where I'm like, you know what? Maybe it's not worth spending $1 million on the marketing and building out a showroom right now because I'm not going to achieve my threshold in order to get my construction financing. That would actually fold my development and that egg's on my face. And if I fold a project and it doesn't really get off the ground, there's not really a lot of people that are running back to buy the project that previously didn't get built. And when you go to Kelowna, if you go back to like 2007, 2008, 2009, man, there was a lot of projects there that didn't get off the ground. And an eerie thing is we sold a building years ago that was on Bernard and it was vacant on the ground floor. Probably the second floor was vacant too, I think. But when you walked in, it was the 2007, 2008 show home still there in like 2020, but a whole bunch more cobwebs. And back then you can look at the show swing like, ooh, teal green. And look at this nice pine wood color. But it was still there. And that was kind of like the market where products never really got taken off. Fast forward to Kelowna now, that obviously has changed, but that market never really materialized. So I think from a developer standpoint, you're not eager to buy anything because right now you're probably sitting on too much and you're not eager to really build anything because I have REDMA and that my equity stack and my cap stack aren't going to make any sense. So what do I do? So now I think you're seeing a lot of developers that are trying to keep people employed and figure out what to do with their land are pivoting to multifamily builds where they have the MLS Select program where my capital requirements are far less than what they once were years ago. And they're far less than me building a strata product today. So I think, long story again, I'm on a tangent here, probably didn't answer the question yet. I think you've got more blood in the water where you got to get land, crappy land, absorbed off the market. And then you go back to like immigration and international students, international buyers, Airbnb. All of that stuff has played a factor. And we could probably run a 6-hour episode on what I think of David Eby and the NDP, but it's like knee-jerk reaction after knee-jerk reaction. And like nothing is ever thought through. And a great example is taking away the Airbnbs, which is pretty much all Penticton and Kelowna, for lack of better words, where all these projects were marketed at Airbnbs because people are doing Airbnb performas. And now I'm paying too much for the condo that I can't sell. And now I got to rent it for half the price. Well, if the three of us go rent an Airbnb in Kelowna, we're going to go to the Rockets game. We're going to have beers before the game. We might go out and have a beer after the game. We're going to wake up, go for brunch. We're going to go for lunch somewhere. Might even have a beer
at brunch.
Yeah, but yeah. Have a hot tub beer at 9 in the morning. But it's kind of like, sorry, we had the William Ray Retreat last week, so I heard a lot of good stories. But we're spending money in that economy. And now you take that Airbnb out and you put a 12-month person in, they're not going to be spending the same amount of money the three of us would spend in the 3 days we're there versus the 12 months they're there. So now you have economic impact. And no one probably thought this through. And now it's swinging from like an iron fist of like, no Airbnbs, to kind of like, hey, we're monitoring it, which is code word for we messed up. We didn't think it would impact the way it did. So I'm going to go back and try to figure that part out. So a whole bunch of knee-jerk reactions, I think, is what's really kind of like all of that stuff combined plays a factor into what does development land and development look like over the next 24 to 36 months.
Yeah, the interesting thing, I think, and I made this point before, but like for the land assembly stuff, like the single family homes, the curious part is that you can actually sell it to an end user for a higher price than you can a developer, right? So there's like two different markets with two different prices, which makes it kind of even, you know, I think your point's well taken about kind of clearing out the inventory and more blood in the water. But in a lot of these cases, you know, it's like, well, wait, I live here. Why like, I don't,
yeah,
you approached me. I don't have to move. I definitely don't have to coordinate with three neighbors to move when that price will be significantly lower than if I just decided to sell my house on the resale market. But
and I think the same metrics go into like strata windups, right? Every strata in a wood frame windup was called years ago that was within a stone's throw of a SkyTrain. And now you're going to them and you're like, well, we can get you $350 a door, but you can sell your condo to an end user at like $410. And they stare at you puzzled. Because the metrics just don't work anymore. Yeah. I don't think they're going to get back to those crazy times anytime soon because there's just too much.
Yeah.
There's not enough absorption, too many hurdles to overcome as a developer, and ultimately too much land out there. Like I'm sure every major developer is getting pitched everything under the sun at 50 cents on the dollar. Like why? I mean, there's not an eagerness to buy this stuff.
Well, and we were talking about like, it's funny, this is going back to your comments earlier, Corey, about location, location, location. Matt and I have had a few conversations recently just about kind of the amount of one beds that were developed in Metro Vancouver. And so like specifically, we were talking about like Tri-Cities and Fraser Valley. But this idea of like right now trying to find the bottom for some of this product when buyers right now are looking at like really what's happening is it's almost like if you have a one bed in say, I don't know, Port Moody, you're actually competing with almost all of Metro Vancouver, where if you have a one bedroom in Kits, you might be competing with Fairview, Mount Pleasant and Kits, right? Like it's super tight inventory, but location in the residential market has never mattered more. And then also what's happened is that gap between Vancouver and the rest of the region has narrowed significantly. And now buyers that had to go to say, I don't know, Port Moody or Coquitlam Center or Surrey or wherever they were going without maybe a good reason other than affordability now can afford Vancouver.
Yeah.
And so they're coming back to Vancouver. And I think like the real lesson that we're taking about it from it is like, you know, tier one product in blue chip locations is fairly market resilient if you can buy it. And it kind of goes against the boat rises with all tide logic, but it's definitely the safest residential asset right now. I mean, consideration.
The other point to that, Adam, like, so say if you're looking for a unit in potentially Coquitlam and you're considering Burnaby, Burquitlam, Port Moody, maybe even Poco, like there's a ton of one beds. But the other thing about the Kits, Fairview, Mount Pleasant is there's not a lot of new development there. Whereas Burquitlam, you know, how many more hundreds or thousands of units are coming, right?
Like you could be competing with 61 beds in your complex.
And in Kits, it's like, you know, you got some lease stuff coming, of course, with Jericho. I guess it's Point Grey, but the Cenac stuff. But really, it's like there's not a lot of freehold new inventory coming. So it's hard to be overbuilt in those neighborhoods in Vancouver.
Well, I think one thing both on probably both sides of the coin that demand was so high for anything. People are just buying everything and making the assumption I buy real estate and it goes up, right? That's what I do. But the number one rule of real estate, I think regardless to residential or commercial is location, location, location. And right now when the market weakens, that golden rule becomes further emphasized. So even regardless to how good or bad the market is tier one or tier two, I always think a good location will always be your best investment because markets are cycles. And I mean, we've had a really good cycle for the longest period of time. And now all of a sudden, you know, homeowners, that if you became a homeowner, I don't know, arguably after 2012, you've never really experienced a negative. Like there was a blip on the radar at COVID, but like you never really experienced the negative. And probably same with brokers, right? Like a lot of brokers in our industry, they've never really had a down market so much. A lot of us were probably order takers in the peak where you're like, you list a property and you got four offers, you got to juggle them. And now you got to go out and market them. I'm like, what do I got to do? So I think location, location, location is the number one rule of real estate. And right now it's shining itself more than ever. And I think a lot of people lost sight of that during the heyday where if they just thought, hey, I buy it, it's going to go up. Like the market's going to do that. But people forget it's a market.
Corey, you're probably having a lot of conversations. Like I'm every broker is having a ton of conversations with anxious sellers right now.
Yeah.
What's one piece of advice for sellers of commercial real estate? And I know it's tough to make any generalizations when you have different asset classes, but what's one piece of advice in a market like this?
Understand the market you're selling into. This is not the 2021 market. It's probably more of a pre-COVID market. And by that, I mean, coming out of COVID, we had free money. Like you were getting 3.5 cap rates in Chilliwack. Like the lower mainland was like regional cap rate. It wasn't like Vancouver is this and Burnaby is this. It's like the whole lower mainland was the same stupid cap rate, which made no sense. And a lot of people that bought product then, they paid too much. They probably couldn't sell it to them if they wanted to because they're underwater. So I think know the market you're selling into. You have to have reasonable expectations. And one reason just from like our standpoint on the brokerage side, why we've had a huge uptick, I think, in transactions is just managing clients' expectations on the sell side. Like if your property is not worth $10 million, we're not going to take it on and then just disappoint you later with an offer of six. You have to understand that it's probably worth $6 million. And the sharper you list it, the better reaction you're going to get. It's not like, it's worth six and I'll take six. We'll list it at 7.5. Well, I don't know about you guys, but in commercial, the listing doesn't say 7.5 million, small print, we'll take six. It says 7.5. So when I'm a buyer, I'm like, that's such a huge delta to make up. I'm on to the next property. So if it's worth six and you understand that and you know it's going to sell for that, let's go like 6.25. Our job as brokers are just to get to the number where you need to get to. Whether they offer us five or 5.9, we still got to get to six. So the sharper we price it, the more in line with market is, the more attention you're going to get. And sometimes offers can be few and far between on assets. So I think understanding the market you're selling in today will be the biggest difference between a sale this year and not selling this year. I think the other thing you look at too is, I mean, if brokers are taking on inflated pricing listings, that can be a sign they're not doing a lot of business. And if a broker's like, hey, I'll list it for 6.25 because I'm doing a lot of deals right now. If you want to list it where I tell you I can sell it, I'll take on your listing. If you want to list it for $9 million, I'm not your guy because I don't have time to show your listing and then just disappoint you because it's not worth it. So understand the market you're selling in today will make a big difference. And a broker can be a key part of that.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Corey. We do have this segment called the Five Wire Five Lighthearted Questions to end the show.
Well, we're at nothing pack right now because I've gone into hiding, like hibernation here. But we're coming back with the Commercial Real Estate Podcast and we're bringing back that six pack.
So the Five Wire, one book you've read, I feel like you're a listener of books, Corey.
I am a listener of books. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm more of like a podcast person. My books have kind of fallen off the shelf lately. But I will say one book I did listen to that I'm a hockey dad. I got an 8 and 10 year old thing. I would definitely not put myself in the crazy hockey parent bucket. I know all the money I'm going to spend and all the driving and all the time I'm going to invest. If I look at the odds, it's going to determine what level of men's league at 8 ranks my kid plays. The more money I spend now, we could be Div 2. If I ignore him, it's probably Div 6. But I definitely do not have any expectations of my kids going anywhere in hockey. That said, I want to support them. I don't want to crush their dreams. I just think there's reality there. So all of that said, again, long tangent. Chris Pronger's was a really, really good book.
Is it financial or is it about hockey?
It's kind of the behind the scenes of his hockey career and how lessons he learned in hockey that he now relates to life and business. And it's really interesting because we all kind of grew up with Chris Pronger at our age. So he kind of talks to like situations that happened over the years that we probably saw unfold through TSN And he kind of sheds light behind the scenes that we can relate to them. And he talks about that. So I would say I was very pleasantly surprised with the book. It's not a long one to listen to. It's probably a couple hours, but I would definitely give it a read. It's really good. And one thing I will say, and again, this is Chris Pronger's side of the story here, and he's a really big guy, and his fists are probably bigger than my face. So I'm saying this, if I ever run into him, I'm going to deny it. Remember that time when he went to Edmonton and he got traded a year later, and there's all those rumors about he might have done something he should have done, and his wife's like, get me out of here. So in his book, he sheds light on it. This is Chris Pronger's side of the story. So how it goes, I hope I'm not ruining this for anybody. How it goes is he gets traded to Edmonton, which he has no idea really what it is. He talks about how his wife had to go to like Chapters to get a book on Edmonton because she had no idea really what it was. So they do this thing and they kind of, I guess, as a family said, hey, we're going to do a year here. Let's see how it goes. And his agent calls him back and says, hey, they want more term out of you. We're not going to do a year. So I guess at this point in time, he describes it kind of like his wife's gone to bed. They've agreed as a family, we're going to do a year. And at this point, he drinks. Now he doesn't drink anymore, he says. But at this point, he was drinking. And 1:30 in the morning, probably not in the right state of mind, he agrees to a five-year contract and has to tell his wife the next day sober that he agreed to a five-year contract. And he said, what happened was it wasn't a good scene. So he had kind of gone to his agent then and said, hey, like we got to unravel this. Like we're going to play out the year, but I'm telling you now, once the season ends, I need a trade request. Like we're done. We're not doing this. I'm in trouble. And he said it was the hardest year he played because that was the year that Edmonton went to the Stanley Cup final and lost to Carolina in 2006. So he said to go to battle every night with these guys with the weight on his shoulders, knowing that once the season ends, he's out of town. He said it was really hard. So that was the Chris Pronger side of the story. It probably wasn't what we heard in the media of him probably doing something
he
should have done.
But also it was a lesson that you shouldn't make enormous life decisions at 1:30 in the morning after drinks.
Yeah, it's a great life lesson. Oh. But it's a really good listen to. And if you are
consult your wife before,
kind of grow up in that area. Yeah, like if you grew up in that era, there's a bunch of things that will be really, really part, really you'll relate to. And the second book I listened to for a second time, and you're gonna laugh at me when I say this, 50 Cent book all about like his career in rap. And I only say that because we can all kind of relate to that. And he talks about the business side of the rap business. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I heard In the Club for the first time on my 16th birthday, should not have been in Roosters, on my 16th birthday in Roosters. But what it was is it comes on and it starts talking about, it's your birthday. Well, he sheds light on why they put that line in. He's like, what happens every single night of the week in a club? It's someone's birthday. So if we talk about it's your birthday, you're going to go request our song. So like he talked about like the business side of how they like deliberately did things. And I'm like, good book.
That's awesome.
A little bit of rap, a little bit of hockey for you. A little bit of rap, a little bit of hockey. 1990s, baby.
All right. So, Cor, I'm trying to figure out how old I was. I think I was actually probably the legal age to be at the club. So, yeah. Okay, come off it. All right. So, question number two, Corey, what is one habit, practice, or belief that you've adopted recently that's had a positive impact on your life?
Can't say Peloton.
This is going to sound really fun. No, I definitely can't say it. So this is kind of like the reverse Peloton. So I think I've come to grips that as I get older, I'm just going to get fatter. So that said, I've bought slightly bigger pants than I normally wear. And it's impacted my life very positively. I don't feel like I'm like a sardine in my pants anymore. And that's probably led to smarter life decisions just all the way around that I've come to grips that I am going in the wrong direction.
Man.
So my new belief is I'm going to get fatter, not skinnier. And all those clothes I've had in my closet for 10 years that one day I'm going to get back into, I've actually gotten rid of those clothes. Like I've parted that way. 2021 pricing does not exist in 2026 for sellers. My clothes from 2020 do not exist in my closet anymore for me. I've parted ways. I'm going to be a pair. I'm going to look like a pair moving forward.
We've never had elastic waistbands as a practice on the show. So this is...
Well, I'll elaborate on that. So like you get Lululemon waistbands and they've got this drawstring around them and they're a little tight. I've gone to Aloe waistbands because they're like an inch thick and they don't have nearly as much pull, much more give. So my midsection's actually gotten a little too big that I've now had to shift from Lulu to Aloe. Like when you're shifting athletic wear pants, you know you're getting fat because like Lulu just fits everybody. But now I have to go to Aloe because the Lulu bands are just too tight for my body. Aloe, I'm still an extra large. Lululemon? probably double extra large now. So psychologically, it's helping me as well that I still get to the same size.
Well, you look great.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't see my waistline right now. Don't lie to me. You can't see my midsection.
What are you listening to music-wise these days, Corey? Music recommendation.
Yeah, I'm going to go there. I'm going to lie to you on the drive-in. I was doing classic Tim McGraw, Sun's Out, classic Tim McGraw, but highly recommend the new Luke Combs album. Really good album.
Fantastic. Nice. Favorite movie recommendation, or what are you binge watching these days?
I'm not going to lie to you. I don't get a lot of time to watch TV. And when I do, we were kind of watching the Stanley Cup finals. But what I would say, last thing I binge watched, this is going to sound really bad. On Netflix, there's a series called Crazy Exes, I think it's called, where they've got like these stories of like these crazy ex-boyfriends and girlfriends and stuff like that. And there's this one, the very first episode, this guy like kills people. He was really weird.
Tattooed guy.
Yeah, the tattooed guy. His face is tattooed. Yeah, you saw the episode? Creepy as anything. But yeah, I would say that's kind of what I've been watched. That me been watching is like one episode per month. But I'm really looking forward to the new season of Selling Sunset coming out on Netflix that they're filming right now, and the new Owning Manhattan that apparently they've already filmed. So I'm looking forward to those shows. I'm not going to lie to you. Definitely watch Selling Sunset.
Real Housewives?
You know what? Years ago, I used to watch New Housewives of New Jersey because they had Teresa and she was a nut job. So she always created good TV. And then if you kind of got into the OC a little bit, but besides those two regions, I never really got into the Housewives. You guys?
No.
Nope.
No, but I feel like it ties in with the Selling Sunset a little bit. But
well, the difference is Selling Sunset, every 15 minutes, I drop a house for sale, right? So it's kind of like, it's a soap opera around a house. And it was by the same guy that produced The Hills. Remember The Hills back in the day?
Vaguely, yeah.
Remember The Hills back? Yeah, I was, don't give me vaguely. Come on. We all remember The Hills. Spencer Pratt, right?
He's back.
And, he's now running for mayor, I think. He's back. He's running for mayor.
I think, I think he got kicked out. I don't think he.
Is he out? Okay. Well, there you go. I'm going to get on the TMZ.
Last question for you, Corey. Something under $1,500 you've purchased that has had a profound impact on your life.
I will say now, I don't think it was 15. I think it's probably $200. So I've got like an iPhone 2, right? So now all the new Apple chargers that come out have different ends than what my phone needs. So in my house, the kids all have the new, you know, the new ends to their iPads and stuff. So I'm always scrambling to find a charger. And a lot of times I sacrifice my EarPod charging to charge my phone. So I got a dock that has a phone charger and EarPod charger at one time. So that has had a very profound thing where I'm
more important than a lot of things, a lot more expensive, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Well, my EarPods aren't dying halfway through a conversation.
Right.
So that's definitely had a very positive impact. So a charging dock would be the answer 5 minutes after you ask the question. Charging dock.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Corey Wright, El Presidente over at William Wright and managing broker. Adam, I really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, Matt, Corey's still here, so I'm going to say the same. But we had a great conversation with Corey. Tons of takeaways. Corey, anything you want to plug before we leave for the day?
I think, honestly, that was probably the best guest you guys have had on in quite some time. Maybe the best guest you've
this
had
is
on
the Trump history. Effect. Everybody's moving to this. The Trump effect. Yeah. It was terrific.
Well, hey, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. I do have to apologize to everyone. I got to get our act together, get the commercial side going. We are coming there with it. But I think right now, if you are looking to buy and sell, a good broker is the most important part of that transaction, because pricing it properly and knowing the market you're selling into is everything right now.
How can people find you, Corey? And of course, William Wright Real Estate Services.
You can send me an email anytime, corey@williamwright.ca. You can visit our website, williamwright.ca, for the latest and greatest news. Or you can always call our Vancouver office, 604-428-5255. Let us know what you're looking for, and we'll put you in touch with a broker throughout the province.
Fantastic. And if you're looking for a broker on the residential side, of course, vancouverrealestatepodcast.com. We have sellers resources, we have buyers resources, and Adam, as I like to say, we have worked with hundreds of people who have listened to this show over the years, We would love to work with more and work with you to help you sell or buy your home. And we appreciate everybody listening.
Yeah, Matt, how can people get in touch with you?
778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And of course, as a throwback to the old studio, Corey, we got the Kokomo line, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com. Have a great week, everyone. We'll be back.
Okay, take care.
Subscribe today.